You're with the Dylan Hours here at 88.5 KCSN. Lisa Finney here with you as I am every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. bringing you the music of Bob Dylan. And you can find KCSN on the far left of your radio dial at 88.5 FM and also streaming online at kcsn.org. And we have a very special Dylan Hours tonight. The theme for this evening I'm thinking of is Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Years, Music and Conversation with musician and author Sid Griffin. Sid Griffin, former frontman for 1980s Americana pioneers The Long Riders and current leader of the London-based alt-bluegrass outfit The Cole Porters. Sid is also the proud author of several books, including two about Bob Dylan. His first, Million Dollar Bash, Bob Dylan, The Band, and The Basement Tapes, was published by Jawbone Press in 2007, and Dylan Hour listeners may remember that I chatted with him about that book soon after its release. Well, Sid visited with me again this week via phone from London about his brand new book titled Shelter from the Storm, Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Years. And so I'm going to give you a little taste of that, and then we'll be back for some more related music. You're with 88.5 KCSN. Welcome back to the Dylan Hour, Sid.
Well, hi, Lisa. It's nice to be here again.
So, yeah, tell us a little bit about the weather in London right now.
It's nice right now. We've had a dry patch, so much so that there are those that desperately need us to have some rain. It's been very, very pleasant. It's not hot. It never gets hot, but it's warm by British standards and dry by British standards.
Well, that just sounds lovely. Sid, why don't you give us a little overview of your newest book? In the introduction to Shelter from the Storm, Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Years, you acknowledge that there are already several texts on this period of Dylan's career. So tell us, how is your book different?
Well, none of the books on the Rolling Thunder Review era of Dylan in the mid-70s do everything. You have a terrific book by Larry Sloman, which is only the fall 75 tour and doesn't really talk about Ronaldo and Clara and doesn't talk at all about the spring 76 tour. And the same with Sam Shepard's book and so on and so forth. So I wanted to have a book that in one volume, the Dylan fan on your street could pick it up and read all about what his Bobness was doing in the mid-1970s and get it all in one place. The book tries to do Ronaldo and Clarix, talk about that. It tries to explain the touring and what Dylan was thinking, trying to do, and talk about the campaign to free Reuben Hurricane Carter. It tries to do all of it, and so it's a fairly ambitious book, if I say so myself. I talk about all the recording he was doing at the time, and it's I'm very pleased with it. It's good. It's a good encapsulation of the whole era, I feel.
Well, I agree with you. I just finished reading it a couple of weeks ago, and it was really great. And I do love the way that you end the introduction, much in the same way that you did your last answer, where you sort of enumerate all the different things that the book does. And you say there is only one book which does all of those things, and that is the book you are holding. It's a really nice way to set up the anticipation for what follows.
Yeah, I think it is. I try to be true to what I said in the introduction later on in the book.
And you definitely are. So why don't we give the listeners a little bit of, scene setting here. Bob Dylan has just completed, at this point in his career, he's released Blood on the Tracks. It's done wonderfully. It's the summer of 1975, and he is, in fact, back in Greenwich Village. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, he's back in Greenwich Village, and he wants to do something to capitalize, I suppose, on Blood on the Tracks. I don't mean so much from a career perspective, because Dylan doesn't really do things from a career perspective that often. He mainly does things that seem to appeal to his romantic side or his artistic side, not so much the commercial side. So I think he's trying to figure out what the heck to do. And he bumps into a number of people who give him the idea, or the courage, really, to go ahead and do an old idea. Since the 1974 World Tour, even before that, he's talked about going on the road with sort of his gypsy circus kind of thing. and having revolving people in the band and just continuing that he, Bob Dylan, could leave this Gypsy Circus tour and just join it later while other superstars of the era took over for him and kept it going. And this is the first time, Dylan's really put his money where his mouth is. And it's a fascinating era. They form this crazy Rolling Thunder Review. They get involved in the campaign to free Hurricane Carter. There was nothing like it. Nothing like it. And that's one reason I think it's important to pop music, period, much less Bob Dylan.
Before he actually launches the Rolling Thunder Review, before he's assembled those folks, he is in Greenwich Village and he's kind of hanging out at the...
He's visiting old haunts and he keeps bumping into people from his past that now are going to loom large in the next few years. He bumps into Jacques Levy, who he admired from writing the Chestnut Mare with Roger McGuinn for the Byrds. He loved that song, and Jacques's the guy that got McGuinn to write those kind of cinematic, but theatrical lyrics. He bumps into McGuinn. He keeps bumping into Ramblin' Jack Elliott. He sees his old friend Bob Newworth and hangs out with him. And these are the people that eventually prove to be the foundation blocks of the first Rolling Thunder Review. And he starts thinking, what if I went on the road with all of these guys, not just one or two of them, with all of them, and we all did the tour together? It might be kind of evocative of the early days of the Greenwich Village folk scene, you know, 13, 14, 15 years earlier. And it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people don't have the courage to follow up on a dream like that or an artistic notion like that. And Bob Dylan has that courage and certainly made it come to happen.
Tell us a little bit about the Bitter End and the Other End Club, it being known by both of those names.
Well, the Bitter End and the Other End are the exact same place. Paul Colby had the name, and his business partner, whose name escapes me, went out west to get involved with TV, ended up doing things like Dukes of Hazzard and WKRP in Cincinnati, and sold the club to Paul Colby, who's Dylan's dear friend, sort of a father figure to young Bob Dylan. But Colby didn't have the rights to the name. So a lot of people remember it as the Bitter End, and then it for about a year and a half, 2 years, it had to become the Other End, and then went back to being the Bitter End, which I think is what it is these last few years if it's still in existence, because it was until recently. I've been in Europe, so I don't really know. But that's all it was. It's the exact same place. So it was complicated in the early interviews, Lisa, because somebody would say the Bitter End and somebody else would say the Other End. They'd be describing the exact same place. And all that was is some of those old folkies. Some of them were always calling it the Bitter End because that's how they remember it. And others were forgetting that in the mid-70s it had switched over to being the Other End since Paul Colby didn't have the rights to that particular name.
Mm-hmm. So Dylan's down there hanging out with Bob Newworth, and he's hearing people like Patti Smith playing live, and he's hanging out with Jacques Levy. Now, Jacques Levy, the late Jacques Levy, we might remind folks, is... co-author of 7 out of the 9 songs that Bob Dylan included on his Desire album that would be released in 1976. And around that same time, he's writing with Jacques Levy. He's meeting different musicians. You've got a great recollection of the story of when Bob Dylan spies Scarlett Rivera walking down the street in Greenwich Village. Tell us a little bit about that.
Basically, Dylan is in a car with a woman driving, and he stops. He has the woman pull over at an awkward angle to the curb, and the woman is going, what? And she's getting the name, what Bob wants to say, the words right, and then she's turning to this woman and saying, blah, 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 blah. And Scarlett Rivera quotes, and is quoted many times, Lisa, as saying, yeah, it was obvious there was somebody else in the car, you know, leaning over and saying, ask her this, ask her that. So this woman that was driving, you know, she pulls over at an awkward angle and kind of blocks the crosswalk where Scarlett Rivera is going to go through and says, you know, could you know how to play that thing? Where are you going now? Blah, 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 blah. Have you played professionally? What kind of music do you like? And these are questions of woman drivers being fed by the passenger in the front seat next to her. And finally, after this goes on for a while, Scarlett Rivera crouches down a little more and sees that it's Bob Dylan feeding the lady driver these questions. And so they do. They go over to a loft where Dylan is staying, and he sits down at the piano and plays a lot of songs off that were going to be on Desire and a couple of things from Blood on the Tracks, and starts smiling when, I can't remember what song it is. It's in the book, of course. Starts smiling to one given song, thinking, wow, this is going to work. And the next night, they went out and played again. She ended up on stage with, of all people, Muddy Waters, jamming away with Dylan on harmonica and the Muddy Waters band churning it away, and our dear friend Scarlett Rivera on violin churning it away.
So, wow. So you've got Scarlett Rivera being recruited. Dylan also recruits Emmylou Harris, of course, for the background vocals. Rob Stoner on bass, someone else that he meets at the other end or the bitter end. Yeah. Ronnie Blakely, Stephen Soulsby, different people being assembled, and then recording the Desire album. That being recorded during July and October of that year of 1975. Yeah. What, in your opinion, are the strongest songs off that record? Are there any Sid Griffin favorites?
Desire? God. I think Romance and Durango's genius. I just think it's just absolutely terrific. I was playing Oh Sister the other day, and I realized he's rewritten Girl from the North Country, so I'm going to have to dock that one a notch. Let me look at it, and I'll tell you. I think Hurricane is a noble song, but because he gets a few of the facts wrong, it always kind of bugged me. Isis is tremendous. One More Cup of Coffee, which is really, Dylan talks about people reading things into his lyric that are from his personal life. Well, One More Cup of Coffee is clearly, to me, reading something into his personal life, or from his personal life, Lisa, about his time in the south of France after in the early 1970s, he was hanging out with a gypsy king. Yeah, Romance in Durango is probably my favorite. One More Cup of Coffee is terrific. Oh, Black Diamond Bay, that's terrific. I haven't mentioned Sarah, but Black Diamond Bay, it's in the next to the last, it's the next to last song in the record. Now, your listeners may not know this. In the days of vinyl, when Desire came out, it was originally on vinyl, of course, the next to the last slot on an LP was called the graveyard slot. And that was where all the record companies, when the LP was invented, as the time went on a little bit, they figured out you put the weakest track on the album in the graveyard slot, because that's where people sort of start to lose any attention they've had. And then they perk up a bit for the last song, thinking, well, this is going to be a big ender. But I think it's just a terrific song, fantastic song, and doesn't deserve any kind of graveyard slot at all. I mean, you could have started an album with that. It's funny, Dylan's stuff is so strong that if so many of people that I know it put Black Diamond Bay on an album, any old place, it would be the strongest song on an album. It's fantastic. You listen to the whole song and think it's happening to the guy, and at the end of the song there's this big twist that he's viewing something on the news.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, I don't know, I think in terms of songs, it's an embarrassment of riches. I think it's a terrific record.
In your list of those wonderful songs, you mentioned two out of the three songs that Bob Dylan, Scarlett Rivera, Rob Stoner, and Howie Wyeth would perform at the World of John Hammond tribute in September of 1975. Tell us a little bit about that, because you talk about it in your book, Shelter from the Storm, Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Years.
Well, they just did three songs at the tribute to John Hammond, and they did one of the songs actually a second time, so one could argue they did four songs. But it's interesting. You know, Dylan, he was criticized later that night for not saying something nice about John Hammond. But I think the whole point is, just for being there, he was saying how much he appreciated what John Hammond had done for him. And I think that was enough that he was there performing live. I mean, the guy doesn't perform live for hardly anybody. So I think it's just was an amazing tribute. Now, Scarlett Rivera says before they went on stage to play, Dylan changed the keys of a couple of things to non-friendly keys for the violin, stuff that violinists would have a tough time with. And she feels that was because Bob wanted to keep them on their toes, her and the bass player, Rob Stoner, on their toes. I don't know if that's true or not, but it does make some sort of sense. And I just feel that it's you can see it now on YouTube, all those clips from that John Hammond tribute. You can see it on YouTube. And Dylan is, he gives a cracking performance. He's just a cracking performance. He's profusely sweating, too. That's the other thing I always remember when I look at those clips or think about those clips. He's sweating like he's just, I don't know what, like he's on his way to be auctioned off or something. It's incredible.
Now, you mentioned in the book that he is not going to remove that leather jacket no matter what, even though he's obviously hot.
No, he's obviously hot. Under hot light. just incredible. Take the jacket off, dude. But, you know, he's got an image. Bless his heart.
They sat together in the park as the evening sky got dark. She looked at him and he felt a spark tingle to his bones. First then he felt alone and wished that he'd gone straight and watched out for a simple twist of fate. Walked along by the old canal, a little confused, I remember it well. Stopped into an old hotel with a neon burning bright. He felt the heat of the night. It is like a freight train moving with a simple twist of fate. Someplace softly played as she was walking on by the arcade. She heard the melody rise and fade. The sun was coming up. She dropped a coin into the cup of a blind man at the gate and forgot about a simple twist of fate. He woke up. She was gone. He didn't see nothing but the dawn. He got out of bed and put his clothes back on. Pushed back the blind. Found a note she'd left behind, to which he just could not relate. All about a simple twist of fate. He hears the ticking of the clock. Walks alone through the city blocks. Hunts her down by the waterfront docks, where the sailors all come in. Maybe she'll see him once again. How long must he wait? One more time for a simple twist of fate. People tell me it's a crime to feel too much at any one time. She should have caught me in my prime. She would have stayed with me instead of going off to sea and leaving me to meditate upon that simple twist of fate.
KCSN, Bob Dylan on vocal, guitar, and harmonica, Scarlett Rivera on violin, Rob Stoner on bass, and Howie Wyeth on the drums, performing live at the World of John Hammond Tribute at WTTW-TV in Chicago, Illinois. That was held and taped on September 10th, 1975, and broadcast on PBS on December 13th, 1975, and we heard Simple Twist of Fate And you may have noted there were some alternate lyrics there from those that had been included on the version on Blood on the Tracks. You're with 88.5 KCSN, and you are with the Dylan Hours. Now we're going to resume our chat with Sid Griffin, and we're getting a little bit closer to the actual Rolling Thunder review tours, and he's got some more to tell us and share with us that he examines in his book. You're with 88.5 KCSN. So he's completed the recording of the Desire album. He's assembled those musicians that we've been talking about, Scarlett Rivera, Rob Stoner, Howie Wyeth, with other people that he's been hanging out with in Greenwich Village, and he puts together this Rolling Thunder review caravan of musicians. Tell us a few more of the names that joined this caravan.
As they went on, he always wanted to have it not just rely on Bob Dylan. So as they went on, it wasn't just him with Joan Baez and McGuinn. It wasn't just Dylan giving newcomers like Rob Stoner a chance. I mean, T-Bone Burnett got to sing Werewolves of London, which is pretty weird when you think it wasn't a hit for another 2.5 years. But T-Bone knew Warren Zevon, as he recounts in the book. He knew it was an arresting song that the first time one sang it, people would get all excited about. So he did that. I mean, Dylan was being very, very generous with his time and the time of people on stage on this tour. And he had it so that when you went to, say, Canada, that they would have Gordon Lightfoot do a few shows. Or in Canada, you know, they dragged out Leonard Cohen. Now, he didn't want to sing our Leonard, which is a shame, but that's fair enough. He was brought to the gigs, and they were trying to get him to sing. He wouldn't do it. And Ronnie Hawkins came out to sing, and Rick Danko came out to sing here and there. And it depended where you were. They when they went down south, they had Willie Nelson. It just depended where you were who was going to come along and be invited. And I find that amazing. I mean, I love long shows by other people, but you don't see Springsteen stopping his show and letting somebody else sing like 4 or 5 numbers. I mean, it just doesn't happen. And this is what Dylan and the gang were doing every night. We'd be someplace and have a regional artist that they all knew, loved, and respected come up and sing a bit. And Dylan might even leave the stage, frequently would leave the stage. And I just find that just generous and amazing. And it was a very lengthy show, but what a terrific one to have seen.
I know. I just wish that I had just been around a little bit, of club-going age at that time, so I could have been there.
Well, I'm afraid I was around, but I was in college. I couldn't quite go. I was in the South at the University of South Carolina. I had friends that went in New England that said it was just fantastic. One of my friends swears he can hear himself yell on Live 1975 up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that it's his voice going, ah, at one point. Mm. But I think he's lying.
On Bob Dylan's bootleg series, Volume 5.
Yeah, I swear he hears his voice, but I think he's jiving me. But it's just, there's been nothing like it before or since. You just haven't seen this in pop music where a guy like Dylan would, you know, sell the tickets and then leave the stage and let Bob Newirth or Joan Baez or whomever they were, you know, whatever town they were in that night, it might be somebody else, take over and sing for maybe a half hour. You just didn't see that. I mean, Joni Mitchell would come out and do some fairly long sets, you know, and you just, it's generous, and obviously people would love to see Joni Mitchell sing, but at the end of the day, they didn't buy a ticket with her name on it.
Right.
And so she might come along for 4 or 5 shows and sing, and it's just, it's incredibly generous of Bob. And also, it makes the show, I don't know, more of an event, if you will, Lisa. I remember when I was a kid, I saw Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels play at the State Fair, and I loved them. I was just a little boy. So I went a few nights later to see Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels play again at the State Fair before they shut it. It was the exact same show with a lot of the same gags at the same place at the same time. And not to cause a major league scandal, but I saw Springsteen at the Sports Arena back in the day, and he ran to the bucket during Rosalita and stuck his head in at the same time and slapped his head back, and the water went everywhere at the same time of both shows I saw. Another thing Springsteen did at the same time in both shows I saw, and I'm not knocking that. They were fantastic shows, both Mitch Ryder and Springsteen. They were terrific shows. But this Dylan show, they're kind of winging it at times. And I went through every single show. I've heard every single show but two. And the set list really jumps around.
Mm-hmm.
It is not just like Bob stands there and sings, you know, Blowing in the Wind or whatever at this time. He sings Like a Rolling Stone there, and he sings Romance and Durango here. Man, they really move it around. Everybody does. I mean, the amount of songs the backing band must have been required to know or maybe rehearsed that day, it must have been incredible. Incredible. And it just, you just don't see a show like that that's growing and sort of almost amorphous, undefinable mass of a show that changes. They're more likely to be structured like a Springsteen show is today, or for that matter maybe Tom Petty or even George Clinton. I mean, it's just, it's incredible. They're just free for all shows based on the moment and the whim and the muse and the way the wind's blowing, which is the way Dylan's career has been a lot of time. But to just see a whole four-hour show like that, or maybe even 5 hours some nights, it's just incredible. It must have been amazing. And I could kick myself for not going.
We want to do this for Larry, our favorite reporter, who's out there somewhere. He tells it like it is. I laid on the field and I looked at the sky when the children were babies and played on the beach. You came up behind me, I saw you go by. You were always so close and still within reach. Sarah, Sarah, whatever made you want to change your mind? Sarah, Sarah, so easy to look at, so hard to define. I can still see them playing with their pails in the sand. They run to the water, their buckets to fill. I can still see the shells falling out of their hands as they follow each other back up the hill. Virgin angel, sweet love of my life. Sarah, Sarah, a radiant jewel, mystical wife. Sleeping in the woods by a fire in the night, where you fought for my soul and went up against the odds. I was too young to know that you were doing it right, and you did it with the strength that belonged to the gods. Sarah, Sarah, wherever we travel, we're never apart. Sarah, Sarah, beautiful lady, so dear to my heart. Sounds of those Methodist bells. I've taken the cure and it just got through. Staying up for days in the Chelsea Hotel, writing sad eyed lady at the lowlands for you. Sail, 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 we're always around. You must forgive me my unworthiness. Now the beach is deserted, except for some kelp and a piece of an old ship that lies on the shore. You always responded when I needed your help. You gave me a map and a key to your door. Glamorous nymph with an arrow and bow. Sarah, oh Sarah, don't ever leave me, don't ever go.
KCSN, the music you want streaming at kcsn.org. We heard a live version of Sarah, and that one presumably dedicated to journalist Larry Sloman, who was covering the Rolling Thunder review for Rolling Stone at the time, and who would subsequently compile and publish his notes in the memoir On the Road with Bob Dylan. And of course, we had Bob Dylan and the whole band there performing at the Palace Theater in Waterbury, Connecticut on November 11th, 1975. Here with the Dylan Hours at 88.5 KCSN, and we are having a chat with musician and author Sid Griffin. Actually, I had the chat with him just a few days ago over the phone. He is in London, and I'm sharing highlights from that chat. Mr. Griffin has just put out his second book about Bob Dylan, this one titled Shelter from the Storm, Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Years. And so we're chatting about Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Years, particularly the period between 1975 and 1976 when he was touring and he was writing lots of songs and he was working on some other side projects. So we're going to resume our chat with Sid now. You're with 88.5 KCSN. It does strike me in reading several of the chapters in your book, Shelter from the Storm, Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Years, that he seems to be in this spot in his creative life where he is, again, absorbing as well as producing. So it does seem to fit that he would want to surround himself with these different musicians. And I know that you have a really interesting section in the book, again, when you're talking about the Other End Club and the different younger musicians that Bob Dylan is meeting and being inspired by. Particularly, you mentioned Patti Smith and Bette Midler. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Patti Smith and Bette Midler, Patti Smith was an unknown at that time. In New York, she was very popular. And the great Bob Newirth, who's a lovely guy, lives in Santa Monica. Newirth is the guy that he's just got taste. I mean, he's just I think he's an incredibly underrated musician himself. And I loved his record, Havana Midnight, but that's another story for another time. Anyway, Newirth, I think, is an incredibly underrated guy in his own right. He's, I guess, largely a painter, but he's Dylan's dear friend. Many of your listeners would know him as being the road manager in the movie Don't Look Back. And it's my understanding that's him standing behind Bob on the cover of Highway 60 Run Revisited, the legs and the striped shirt holding the camera. Mm-hmm. But Newirth not only has been sort of Dylan's, I don't know what, alter ego or best friend and road manager. He's the guy that told Dylan, no, the Birds, Mr. Tambourine Man, this is hot, Bob, this is good, this is great. He's the guy that, you know, when Mary Martin had the Hawks come up to the office, it was Newirth who would say, thumbs up, this is Robertson, what a guitar player, Danko, what a bass player, these are the guys, Bob, these are the guys. And he's done that throughout his career, as David Mansfield talks about in the book. And it was Newirth who told Patti Smith, you're really great, but there's a rock and roll element to your poetry, and I think you should have a backing band behind you playing rock and roll while you recite this stuff. I mean, he's been an incredible influence, Newirth, on the, sort of the 20th century's art. And when he was doing this, he introduced Patti Smith, you know, who had the band together, to Dylan. They said, you got to see this girl play, this woman play. So he took Dylan to see the gig. And the Patti Smith Band, as your listeners probably do know, could improvise. They could improvise behind Patti Smith when she went off on one of these poetry jags and start speaking rapidly in the way that I'm speaking rapidly now, maybe reading a pre-written poem, or maybe reading something that she's improvising right there, reciting something she's improvising right there on the spot. So Patti Smith wanted to work with Dylan. They had their picture taken together. They were really smitten with each other, but she just couldn't do this tour for various reasons. I mean, she didn't feel she could go without her band. I'm putting words in her mouth. I shouldn't do that, but the word is she didn't feel like she could go on this tour without her band. It was the Patti Smith Group. Yes, her name was out front, but to go without the band right at that point when the band is what she was pushing, if you follow me there, she wasn't just pushing Patti Smith. She was pushing the Patti Smith Group. So she didn't want to go without them, and they couldn't have another whole bunch of musicians on at the same time. Plus, she had some commitments in New York anyway. So that was, alas, I think, a missed moment for Miss Smith, but she's done so well, it doesn't matter. I think she's laughing at me somewhere for saying that. Mm-hmm. And then Bette Midler, who you don't really associate with Bob, he sang Buckets of Rain on her album, I think it was Songs for the New Depression, I think that's the one he sang on. Mm-hmm. And they just hit it off. I guess you've got two outsiders in New York. They're both from I think Bette Midler is, I believe, from Hawaii, and Bob's from Minnesota, and they're in New York, you know, in the showbiz game, and they hit it off. Two brainy, sassy, you know, intellectual Jewish minds that hit it off. And Midler, I think, would have been a staggering addition to the Rolling Thunder Review. But as far as I know, the Divine Miss M was never invited to actually make the tour. I don't know that for a fact, but I don't think she got as close to the starting gate as Patti Smith did. But I think that would have been mind-boggling to have the Divine Miss M come out and sing a couple of songs. I remember I went to a gig in Santa Monica where Lightnin' Hopkins opened for Bonnie Raitt, and I'd never seen Lightnin' Hopkins, so I actually went, no offense to Bonnie Raitt, I went to see Lightnin' Hopkins, and he was terrific, really cool. And then I saw Bonnie Raitt's show, and it was great. It was before the big breakthrough of that album in 1990. And then, to top it off, Bonnie Raitt's dad came out, the great John, the great Broadway theatrical show tune guy, and he sang Oklahoma from the Carousel and all that, and he tore the house down. I thought that must have been what it would have been like if Bette Midler could have gone on the Rolling Thunder Review. She'd have gone out there, and these kids would have gone, what the heck is this? And she could have sang some, you know, Broadway show tune and just knocked them dead. She'd have blown their minds. But alas, it was not to be.
Really? Terrible cry. I always cry.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
What was the last thing that made you cry?
This last night, I had this terrible thing happen to me. It's really a drag. I can't cope. The older I get, the less control over my emotions I have.
What happened last night?
Oh, I just cried. I had to run away from some people. I had to pick my stuff up and run. I ran like a quarter of a mile. It's a drag.
With your suitcase?
No, my little bag.
Why did you run? Why couldn't you walk?
I was scared.
Scared of what?
The
great unknown?
No, it wasn't too unknown. I knew what it was. That's why I ran away.
Where'd you run?
Home. Only a quarter mile. I was so glad to get home. I said goodbye, good night to my fish, and I went to bed. I passed out, and I was glad to get there. Oh, I do it for you, don't you do it for me.
Nuggets of rain, nuggets of sea. Got all them nuggets coming. Nuggets of moonbeams in my hand. You got all the love, honey, baby, I can stand. I bend down, and how do I get over? I've seen pretty people disappear like smoke. Friends will arrive, friends will disappear. I like the heavenly way you look at me. Everything about you is bringing me.
KCSN. Bob Dylan, again, performing an original song of his as a duet with Bette Midler, and you will notice that they took some liberties with those original lyrics, and instead of singing Buckets of Rain, they were singing Nuggets of Rain, and that track, in fact, the banter or rehearsal take of that song, recorded during the October 1975 sessions in New York City for Midler's Songs for the New Depression album. And there is, in fact, a master take of this adaptation that was released on that album in January of 1976. And following that, we heard an excerpt from Bob Dylan's film, Rinaldo and Clara. You heard Bob Dylan musing with poet Allen Ginsberg, the late, great Allen Ginsberg, who traveled extensively with the Rolling Thunder Review. This scene in particular that we peeked into features their visit to novelist and poet Jack Kerouac's grave at Edson Cemetery in Lowell, Massachusetts on November 3rd, 1975. Yeah. And so there you go. That was our side projects during the Rolling Thunder years set. And we will return now here on the Dylan Hours to a little more of my chat from earlier this week with musician and author Sid Griffin, who has just released a book about Bob Dylan titled Shelter from the Storm, Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Years. Here with 88.5 KCSN. So tell us a little bit, you talk about it in Shelter from the Storm, the origin and or meaning of the tour's name, the Rolling Thunder Review, and also the origin and or meaning of the touring band's name, which is Guam, G-U-A-M.
Well, I'll do Guam first.
Okay.
Some of the participants debated how Guam came up, but apparently they were talking about we need a name for this backing band that New Earth had put together with Howie, the wife, on the drums, and he played some piano as well, and Rob Stoner on bass, and T-Bone Burnett on guitar, and you know, Mick Ronson from the David Bowie Spiders Mars Band. This crazy backing band, what are we going to call it? And there was silence for a minute, and New Earth came out with, let's call it Guam. And they all started laughing, and somebody said, well, why? And New Earth went, well, this is a traveling band, and has anybody ever been to Guam? And everyone looked at each other and went, no one's ever been to Guam. And then someone came up with, it's also the furthest west you can go and still have a United States postmark on your letters. And then somebody came up with the United States during the Vietnam War based a lot of bombers on Guam, which is they certainly had a military base there. I don't know if it's a key base for the bombs that are being dropped on the North Vietnam in the war. But that was another reason that it seemed to fit into the puzzle. But mainly New Earth, just, he's got a Dadist, D-A-D-I-S-T, sort of way of thinking. He just popped it out, and there it is. And then the other was Rolling Thunder, of course. People have asked me about that. And it's McGuinn says, you know, when Dylan went outside his house thinking about this tour in Malibu, he sat there on the front step looking out towards the ocean. He heard this boom, boom, boom rolling across the sky. And Dylan thought, oh, wow, Rolling Thunder. And McGuinn said, Roger McGuinn said, I am convinced that what Bob heard was the sonic booms coming from the jets flying over Vandenberg Air Force Base out towards the desert. And then, of course, Rolling Thunder, and I think it's the Nation of the Iroquois, means speaking truth. I believe that's the language, that in the Native American language, it means speaking truth. And the great Doug Boyd wrote a wonderful book called Rolling Thunder, which I wouldn't be surprised if Dylan was very, very familiar with at the time. And then, of course, there's another reason that the Rolling Thunder was a bombing campaign of North Vietnam, hence the tie-in with Guam. So there's a number of reasons that it was called Rolling Thunder. I think the Native American link is the dominant one for Bob Dylan, but it just seemed to fit, and I really think it's a great name for a tour and a band.
And there's a Native American chief named Rolling Thunder, I think, that has been rumored to have made appearances. I don't know if you turned up any information about that.
Yeah, well, the Dylan and the gang, they went to prisons and played, and they went to a Native American reservation or two, and made appearances. You know, they did charitable events, and Rolling Thunder was apparently at one of those events at one of the reservations, yeah. And it's just, I don't know, it's just, you don't really, this is, rock groups just don't do this kind of stuff. And, of course, Bob Dylan's not just any old sort of rock and roll band on tour. He's Bob Dylan, and he's got some crazy ideas when things go out there. I mean, I can't imagine taking all of these guys to sort of impoverished Native American reservations and convincing them that this is going to be a really wild evening, because I mean, a lot of these people want to relax, they want to do this, they want to chase girls, they want to do whatever. And yet Dylan's got them doing some amazing things for the good of the body politic, for the good of the soul, for the good of the society that's around them. He's got them doing some amazing things on tour, and I think it's really wonderful. Yeah, here's the book on my wall right here, Rolling Thunder by Doug Boyd. It's introduction by Dee Brown, of course, who wrote Brain My Heart at Wounded Knee. Fascinating book, fascinating book. I'm sure Dylan would have read this. No question in my mind.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that he's not just having a regular rock tour. He's doing all
not
kinds
all.
Of other things. And you do devote two chapters to the Rinaldo and Clara project that was also going on.
Yeah, I mean, besides all that, it's, I think T-Bone Burnett, Academy Award winner that he is, was gracious enough to give me a nice interview. And he's talking about, you're talking about a tour where we did, you know, charitable events. Where we got involved with the project to release Reuben Hurricane Carter out of incarceration. And it was just a multifaceted thing that most rock bands, I think, don't do. Or if they do, they've done it so quietly, so admirably and so quietly that we never hear about it. But, you know, Dylan, he really does march to the beat of a different drummer. So he's got everybody participating in all these other projects and throws in a making a motion picture on top of it. And at one point, the crew, the cast and crew was over 100 people on the road. And he even told his childhood friend Lou Kemp, who I got a nice interview with for the book, I think it's probably the first time he's spoken about this in decades, I don't care if the tour makes money as long as it doesn't lose money. Well, what kind of brass ring grabbing, gold platinum record obsessed rock star says something like that? Not many of them, but Dylan said it, and it's just an amazing, amazing time in this amazing guy's life.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first leg of Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review kicked off at the War Memorial Auditorium in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and then that was end of October 1975, and then wound up at Madison Square Garden in New York City. And you've mentioned that you've watched a lot of footage from and listened to a lot of recordings from those shows. How would you characterize the first leg of the Rolling Thunder Review?
Well, from what everyone's told me and from what I can hear, all the participants, McGuinn, Arlo Guthrie, I think Lou Kemp alluded to it, certainly T-Bone Burnett, David Mansfield, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, who was on the first tour, they all said the first tour had the vibe, and it was warm, and it was a family, and it was, you know, this cuddly, fuzzy puppy, and they knew they were doing right, and they were doing well, and they were pleased that they had all this footage, and the cameras made it interesting, and so on and so forth. And to a man or to a woman, everyone that I spoke to said, yeah, the second leg kicked off in April of 76 in Florida wasn't this warm, fuzzy puppy. It was more of a syphilic dog that might bite you at any time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to remember that the Hard Rain live album is, of course, in the spring 76 tour, the syphilic dog tour that might, you know. And yet, it's fantastic music. No, it's not like the Live 75 record, which is warmer and more, warmer and more soul-inspiring and soul-uplifting and spiritual in its own way. And it's great, Live 75, the fall tour. All the bootlegs I heard of the shows. Now, Spring 76, Hard Rain, is not soul-inspiring and soul-uplifting at all, but it's stark, it's in your face, it's brutal, it's challenging, it's dynamic, it's a guy dancing on the high wire at 1,000 feet above an intersection. So they're two different things, but I don't want anyone to think that I don't think the Spring 76 tour didn't have terrific music on it, because it did. It had terrific music, but the music was forceful and brutal. It was sort of like, oh, Women Are From Venus. Well, that's the Fall 75 tour. Men Are From Mars. Well, that's the Spring 76 tour. But I don't think one ever eclipsed the other artistically. I do not.
In your chapter on the Hard Rain TV special, you describe Bob Dylan as looking like, quote, a rather concerned, almost sinister, and somewhat underfed Old Testament prophet.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit
and
more about that.
I wonder, I stand by that. If you look at the Hard Rain footage, he does look sort of like an Old Testament prophet up there. They had those hats, I've forgotten the name of them, begins with a K that I'm talking about in the book. They had those caps made, the sort of Arabic caps, and I've often wondered, does he do this on purpose? Is he more conscious Lisa, of his image and his public image and his appearance than he lets on. I've never really decided. But when I looked at footage, particularly of Spring 76, I mean, he looks concerned. He doesn't look happy. He was certainly having, he seemed visibly to be having a lot more fun in Fall 75. But Spring 76, he's on edge. He's kind of pissed off. And I think that Old Testament prophet, stunt double, look-alike or not, when Bob Dylan's got some bug up in his rear, he makes some fantastic art, be that something like the Ballad of Donald White or The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. He wants to sing something righteous about society, like, you know, When the Ship Comes In, or be that about George Jackson or the song Hurricane, when he wants to say something in that era, or be it about he just wants to tell society to bugger off, like Subterranean Homesick Blues, or when he's got something he really has to say deep, 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 deep in the heart, and he comes up with, I don't know, Every Grain of Sand or something. I think that's when we get our best Dylan. And there's some bug in Bob during Spring 76. And I don't know, man. Maybe he put on that sort of garb thinking, I'm going to tell people the way it is and might as well dress like a prophet while I'm being one. But who knows? Who knows what he thinks? He would probably deny every single thing I've said tonight. But there you are. And he might be right and he might be wrong. He is a fascinating figure. He's often said in interviews, he'll say, why doesn't somebody ask Kris Kristofferson questions like that? Or why doesn't somebody ask John Prine a question like that? And the fact is, as terrifically talented as those men and other men and women are in the songwriting game, none of them, through their art and through their even their the way they live their lives, which is the main art, how you live your life, none of them have posed as many possibilities, not questions, they say. None of them has posed as many possibilities as Bob Dylan has. And that's why they're not answering those kind of questions or being asked those kind of questions in interviews, because it doesn't really matter. In the way that it sort of doesn't really matter what Elvis thought about the Vietnam War. You know, it doesn't really matter. Who cares? And the Civil Rights Movement. It doesn't really matter that much. But Dylan, who offers society and the individual, one by one of us, these great possibilities that they could happen, or there is that there, it's like we've got a William Blake walking around here in the 21st century. They probably wouldn't like me saying that about him either, but there you go.
When you mentioned that Bob Dylan sort of needs to get riled up sometimes to deliver a certain kind of song, and we're thinking about that Hard Rain television special, is there any song that comes to mind where you think that he's particularly riled up? Is there one that flies into your memory?
He does a number of things that are fascinating. I mean, I think he takes it a little too far in Lay, Lady, Lay when he changes the lyrics and it becomes, instead of this soft terry cloth ballad from Nashville, it becomes a very sort of harsh piece of sandpaper. I think he goes a little far with the old Lay, Lady, Lay, but stuff like Idiot Wind off the Hard Rain album, he's changed a few of the lyrics, or should I say updated a few of the lyrics. I mean, he's just stomping it. I mean, it's just fantastic. And I, again, I think when there's something bugging Bob and he's got something, a thorn in his side, and I don't know what it was that day. I mean, obviously, the whole tour, apparently, there are those that said he wasn't a happy camper. But, I mean, when he's got something, a thorn in his side, he can come out with a vocal like he does in Idiot Wind on Hard Rain. It's powerful stuff. I mean, it is powerful stuff. In a way, he reminds me of the Bible, because the Bible is this, you know, wonderful book, frequently, like perhaps I am tonight, misinterpreting Dylan. Well, frequently the Bible is misinterpreted, if you allow me to say it on the airwaves. Yet there's so much in it that even the non-believer can get into the Bible and get something out of it. And I think Dylan's that way. I mean, I have friends and relatives that cannot stand his singing voice, but look at the lyrics or listen to, say, The Birds or Joan Baez or whoever do one of his songs, and they love the material. I mean, this is an incredibly important figure, and I just think when he and his muse get together and sit down and have a cup of coffee, and you come out with something like Idiot Wind on Hard Rain, well, man, you're talking, I don't know, it's like there's punk rock bands that wish they had that kind of power, that wish they had that kind of force, that wish they had that kind of command.
From California State University, Northridge, this is 88.5 KCSN and KCSN HD1, Northridge, Los Angeles. Member-supported public radio, streaming on the web at kcsn.org, the music you want. And now, a final thought from Sid Griffin.
one of the great stories or subtext of this book of mine, or even Dylan's life, is he has this great muse in the 1960s and admits later that he lost it, but he fights to get it back. I mean, this is a guy whose art is incredibly important to him. There is no doubt in my mind, I bet not yours, Lisa, that if Dylan had made a few key compromises along the line, he'd be a much, quote-unquote, bigger star than he is now and be making, selling more records and making more money. However, he wouldn't possibly, probably be the cultural iconoclast that he is. I mean, he's an incredibly iconic and important cultural figure. And I think one of the reasons is because he has, to use the great phrase, walked to the beat of his own drummer, excuse me. And that's what I've shown in this book, or tried to show in my book, Shelter from the Storm, the story of Dylan in the mid-1970s. It's just classic. This is like a guy trying to swim, trying to not drown. Dylan is fighting to stay at the surface of the water. And when he does it, it's just, his art is just, it's unstoppable, undeniable, irreproachable. It's just the greatest. I mean, T-Bone Burnett, I think I used the quote in the book, he was talking about, you know, Bob on that tour was singing great, he was performing great, he had written some great songs, he was just at a peak. And I agree. And then T-Bone Burnett said, of course, when Dylan does that, he's as good or better than anybody we've had culturally speaking. And I agree with that, too.
She said,